Mousery, Wallace, and two unwounded yards fired as NVA bullets smacked the helicopter, forcing it to pull out. Four RPGs shook the ground, and Wallace grabbed his face and groaned, "Oh God, I'm hit." Then a Cobra flying so low Mousery felt it over his shoulder let loose a minigun burst that churned the ground 5 yards away. "He just cooked them," Mousery said, and that broke the attack. Temporarily blind, Wallace also had difficulty breathing, so Mousery laid him beside a tree and lied, saying that they'd get out just fine. By that time, he said, "I thought we were toast." Then Covey rider Larry White's voice crackled on the radio, "They're sneaking around your right flank." With White directing from above, Mousery crawled to the edge of the knoll and rolled three grenades over a rise. White reported, "You got him." Momentarily, another Huey came in low above the treetops, just as the NVA rushed the LZ. Only 2 yards and Mousery still fired, and by now the 1-1's overheated Car 15 scorched his hand and melted off the nylon sling. He poured water on it, grabbed magazines off teammates' bodies, and kept shooting. Then A-1s dropped cluster bombs right across the NVA, buying barely enough time to get the Huey in. Somehow, Mousery got Arthie Washington's wounded yards and his blinded team leader aboard, but there was no chance to retrieve Kurt Green's body. Medevac stateside, Captain Wallace lost an eye. Though he died, Kurt Green was carried MIA, and having shown the right stuff, Jeff Mousery was appointed Arthie Washington's new 1-0. It was combat such as this, close quarters, all-out gunfights against masses of NVA, that characterized SOG Recon's final year, a time when its men could no longer even operate as Green Berets of the 5th Special Forces Group. The 5th Group turned over its last A-camp to the Arvin on 21 January 1971, shortly before its withdrawal, a withdrawal accelerated by General Abrams despite its catastrophic effects on the border camps and Mike Force Montagnard units. The Green Berets' official departure created a cover problem for SOG's Special Forces troops, solved by changing CCN to Task Force 1, Advisory Element, while CCC was redubbed Task Force 2, Advisory Element. Recon men swapped Green Berets for black baseball caps and switched to the U.S. Army, Vietnam patch. But more momentous changes were in the wind. On 29 January, I was flying Covey with USAF Captain Jim Cryer over southern Laos when RT Hawaii, led by 1-0 Les Dover, declared an emergency after a heavy firefight. While Hawaii was being extracted, RT Colorado, 8 miles away, also declared an emergency. I turned over Hawaii's extraction to Cobra lead, then raced south to help Colorado. RT Colorado 1-1 David Lurch Mixter was well-liked, an adventurer offspring of a prominent New England family. A solid athlete, Mixter stood 6 feet 6 inches, making him a foot taller than his 1-0, Pat Mitchell, and probably 50 pounds heavier than their 1-2, John St. Laurent. An RPG had killed Lurch and wounded St. Laurent, and though they'd killed 10 NVA, their yards had panicked and fled, and more NVA were massing. Unable to carry Lurch, Mitchell and St. Laurent were about to fight to the death for his body. While my pilot, Jim Cryer, set up for a gun run, I spoke to Mitchell, assuring him, "It's okay. Lurch would understand. We have to think about the living right now, partner. Now get moving." It hurt immensely to leave Lurch behind, but we managed to extract Mitchell and St. Laurent, cheating the NVA of 2 more lives. Though we wouldn't realize it for another week, David Mixter would be SOG's final recon man, MIA in Laos. On 6 February, the Joint Chiefs ordered SOG to cease U.S.-led Laotian missions, a complete surprise to Chief SOG Sadler, who at that moment was overseeing an elaborate deception campaign to support Lam Son 719, the imminent Arvin invasion of Laos. Sensitive to media and congressional charges of illegal Laotian activities, the previous April, President Nixon had danced the edge of a lie, telling the New York Times, No American stationed in Laos has ever been killed in ground combat operations. Although later conceding a few CIA officers had been lost, the White House still didn't mention SOG's ground casualties, and with good reason. After the Cambodian incursion, Congress had passed the Cooper-Church Amendment, which prohibited the introduction of U.S. ground forces into Laos. During an embarrassing incident during the upcoming Arvin invasion scheduled for 8 February, the White House ordered SOG to stop using Americans in cross-border operations. Yet U.S.-led recon missions hardly ended. The Joint Chiefs gave SOG a 10-kilometer-deep strip along the DMZ and Laotian border, with orders to penetrate these heavily occupied NVA base areas, now linked by roads to Laos and North Vietnam. As for Lam's Sun 719, this was to be a 3-division spoiling attack to destroy enemy stockpiles and disrupt truck traffic at the height of the dry season, buying time for South Vietnam, as had the Cambodian invasion. Launching from Khe San, Arvin forces would roll west along Highway 9, destroy NVA facilities around Chipon, turn south on Highway 92, sweep through NVA 559th Group Forward Headquarters, and return to South Vietnam along Highway 922 into the A Sha Valley. It looked fabulous, on paper. 3 times, Chief SOG said, he gave General Abrams, the MACV J-2, and the U.S. 24th Corps commander a blunt recommendation, stay out of there. Sather knew that over the past 4 months, only 40% of SOG teams had remained in Laos over 24 hours. So strong had the NVA become, and warned, they're in position, they know you're coming, and that's a recipe for deadly results. When we briefed 24th Corps staff, recalled Colonel Pinkerton, SOG's operations chief, General James Sutherland said his biggest worry was being able to get in there, and we told him, your biggest worry ought to be how the hell you're going to get out. An official U.S. after-action report never cites SOG's repeated warnings, instead claiming, United States intelligence felt that the operation would be lightly opposed. The same report said, the NVA reinforcement capability was listed as 14 days for 2 divisions from the north of the DMZ, but disingenuously did not note that 14 days before the operation, there was intelligence that the NVA already knew the Arvin were coming. SOG laid on an elaborate campaign to support Lam Son, beginning in mid-January with SOG Blackbirds dropping dummy parachutists with firecrackers, Nightingale devices, on 7 DZs west of Khe San, while U.S. teams faked inserts at another 4 points. SOG also was diverting NVA attention from Operation Silver Buckle, a CIA-advised 4-battalion Laotian attack from southwest of Chipon that had begun on 5 January. 2 NVA regiments quickly routed the CIA SGU force. Meanwhile, atop Ko Rock, just west of Khe San, SOG inserted 3 U.S. recon teams and 2 Arvin-led hatchet force platoons. After the Pentagon message of 6 February, the U.S. teams had to be extracted. On 8 February, the Arvin finally launched its much-anticipated invasion, rolling west from Khe San along Highway 9, while several battalions of Arvin Rangers and paratroopers were helilifted to hilltops on the right and left flanks. Vehicle columns advanced at a reasonable pace on the mostly single-lane Highway 9, which could be blocked by a single disabled vehicle. Cut that lifeline, and the Arvin were trapped. For 4 days, the Arvin had it easy. While the Arvin advanced into Laos, SOG's Naval Advisory Detachment staged its first nasty-class boat raids above the DMZ in 27 months, in hopes Hanoi might fear its vulnerable homeland was about to be invaded. In December 1970, SOG's top Navy officer, Commander Tom Millen, had studied enemy coastal defenses and bet Chief SOG, I could drive 2 nasties up the coast as far as Haiphong and back and not take more than 3 rounds of gunfire, all in my wake. With White House restrictions on SOG raids above the DMZ temporarily rescinded, that's exactly what Sadler wanted to do, raid Haiphong Harbor, which SINCPAC approved subject to a hydrographic study. But sure enough, the Nasties required 8 feet 3 inches minimum draft, and at low tide their safe passage through the Red River Delta could not be assured. Instead, the Joint Chiefs authorized surface combat against North Vietnamese ships. One of the first Nasty forays had to pass up a nice, fat 380-foot Chinese freighter, but shortly afterward, on the night of 11 February, three Nasties patrolling 60 miles north of the DMZ sank a junk, a trawler, and a 100-ton coastal steamer, and damaged 2 Soviet-made submarine chasers. On 19 February came the most successful Nasty surface action of the war, when 4 PTFs on night patrol sank a 60-foot patrol boat and heavily damaged a 130-foot Shanghai 2 fast attack craft and a Swatow-class gunboat. When the North Vietnamese Navy attempted to intercept the escaping SOG boats with a P-4 patrol boat and another Shanghai 2, again the SOG crews got the better of them, disabling the P-4 and sinking the Shanghai 2. Only one SOG Vietnamese crewman was killed. One day earlier, on 18 February, the first of 6 SOG recon teams inserted into the Asha Valley in support of Lam Son 719 to tie down NVA forces and gather intelligence for when the ARVN returned along Highway 922 coming out of Laos. Initially, the Asha diversion had been assigned to the 1st Brigade 101st Airborne Division, which was to storm the valley with 4 battalions. The specter of heavy American casualties apparently scotched that. Instead, a handful of recon men were given a job originally planned for a 2,000-man paratroop unit. The Asha Valley had never been hotter. Captured documents revealed the NVA had moved 11 counter-recon companies there to reinforce LZ watchers, trackers, dogs, rear security units, and infantry battalions. 2 anti-aircraft battalions defended the valley, one at each end. Billy Waugh used Nightingale firefight simulators and false landings on 6 LZs to land a single team, and 10 minutes later the team made contact. The NVA were everywhere. "That's what made me realize finally that the war is lost," he said, "because if they can be in every goddamn kilometer in this son of a bitch, just think of how they are in War Zone D, near Saigon." When Sammy Hernandez told Rich Gross he was going into the Asha for a roadblock mission, Gross advised him not to go, thinking that the operation had no chance. But Hernandez, a recent veteran of the world's first Halo parachute insert, went anyhow, accompanying RT Intruder to advise and evaluate a new 1-0, Captain Ronald Doc Watson, and his 1-1, Sergeant Allen, Little Jesus Lloyd. Watson, who had a doctorate in history from Berkeley, had been assigned to SOG to write a book and ran missions to get a feel for the subject. Inserting on a steep ridge along the Asha's west wall, RT Intruder had not been on the ground 30 minutes when they came upon a heavily camouflaged road. Hernandez had them pull back to wait and listen, and not 2 minutes later a yard on their left flank signaled people coming. A 6-man NVA porter party, which Intruder engaged. 2 of the enemy were shot dead and the others fled, abandoning their loads. Quickly, the recon men gathered their booty and beat feet to an LZ. Covey was still within earshot and got a Huey to them in minutes, but half of RT Intruder's men would have to wait for the helicopter to fly to Phu Bai, refuel, and return. Concerned that too many NVA were converging on the area, Sammy Hernandez told the Covey FAC not to bring back a Huey that afternoon, but to wait until morning. Until then, he, Watson, and Lloyd, the last 3 on the ground, would hide, letting the NVA conclude the entire team had left. That was much safer, Hernandez believed. But 30 minutes later, the FAC radioed that another Huey was on its way in. Watson, Lloyd, and Hernandez had gone only 200 yards from the old LZ, and only about 700 yards from the ambush site. Hernandez thought the extraction a bad idea and warned, "I don't want to do this." The USAF FAC, flying without a SOG Covey rider, disregarded Sammy's warning and sent in the Huey. The bird hovered at the treetops and dropped strings, which the 3 Americans snapped into, then gave a thumbs up to the Huey crew chief. As they lifted up and away, light ground fire erupted, returned by the Huey door gunners. Then Hernandez heard fire right underneath him. He was high enough almost to run across the treetops. And the next thing I knew, I'd come back crashing through the trees. The Huey flew away, beyond where the ridge dropped off. Numb after impact and the wind knocked out of him, his face bleeding, Hernandez thought his rope had snagged and snapped, but found it was cut clean, apparently by the door gunner to save Sammy from being dragged through the trees. But Hernandez was mistaken. The door gunner's last act was slicing Sammy's line when the Huey, fatally hit, tipped upside down. Dragged behind it, Watson and Lloyd followed the falling Huey right over the cliff and died along with the whole Huey crew. In the ebbing light, Hernandez heard movement and voices, so he crawled and slid downhill. He was on his own again, like on the Halo mission. Enemy flashlights scanned the brush for him for about an hour and a half, but his repeated button hooks finally lost them. He found a place to hide and tried to sleep. The next morning he heard a Huey, crawled into a small clearing and waved a panel. An hour later he was back at Phu Bai, safe and secure, and surprised by all the bear hugs from his recon buddies. It was only 24 hours, he kept saying. Finally, Billy Waugh put an arm around his shoulder and told him about Doc Watson and Alan Lloyd. But Sammy's rescue didn't end the story of R.T. Intruder. R.T. Habu, led by Cliff Newman along with Billy Waugh, went after the bodies of Watson and Alan and the Huey crew and had to rappel down a cliff to reach the crash site. While the bright light was underway, a Covey aircraft was shot down, killing both the pilot, USAF Captain Larry Hull, and his Covey rider, Sergeant First Class William Fernandez. Although R.T. Habu found Watson's and Lloyd's bodies, the loss of the FAC plane so complicated everything that the bodies could not be extracted that day. That night, a reinforced NVA company pinned R.T. Habu against a sheer drop and likely would have overrun them at dawn, except the team, with half its men wounded, left behind the bodies and escaped by jumping off the cliff. For months, the NVA left Watson's and Lloyd's body bags in the open, hoping a SOG team or helicopter might come for them. They were never recovered. While the RT Intruder bright light was underway, another team, RT Python, on the Aishaw's east wall, was hit by an NVA battalion. Led by Captain Jim Butler, with Staff Sergeant Leslie Chapman as 1-1, RT Python's 14 men had occupied Firebase Thor, a small abandoned hilltop strongpoint, to block the NVA-controlled highway below them. The audacious Butler had even erected a flagpole and run up Old Glory for all the world to see. RT Python had gone in heavily armed with a 60mm mortar, four M60 machine guns with 5,000 rounds per gun and whole cases of M79 grenade rounds. They ringed their little fortress with 57 Claymore mines. The first night they were only probed and took occasional mortar rounds. All night they watched flashlights and vehicle headlights on the valley floor. They suffered two wounded, but the RT Intruder bright light precluded a medevac. Just after dark the next night, the NVA began shelling their hilltop with mortars and recoilless rifles, then launched a heavy assault at 11:30 p.m., making it within hand grenade range before a C-130 Spectre's 40mm and 20mm guns pushed them back. At 4 a.m., the NVA launched another attack, beaten back by 60mm mortar fire and Car 15s and another Spectre. But the NVA would not quit. At 8:30 a.m., in broad daylight, with aircraft circling above, the NVA launched an all-out battalion-strength assault that should have swept right over the team. Concentrated A-1 strafing guns and napalm, along with heavy fire from Butler's men, barely held the enemy back. Then a yard was shot and rolled down the slope. Despite heavy enemy fire, 1-1 Chapman scrambled after the wounded Montagnard, killing four NVA and throwing the yard over his shoulder, then running back to safety. Their supporting Covey pilot, Captain Tom Yarborough, hailed two passing Hueys, which narrowly snatched away R.T. Python before NVA swarmed over the top. Then it was realized 1 yard had been left behind. His ordnance expended, Captain Yarborough held off the NVA by bombing them with empty rocket pods and his auxiliary gas tank while a Huey retrieved the yard. Butler's men were credited with killing 42 enemy and directing air that killed an additional 300 NVA. Les Chapman was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. Although SOG's Ashaw Valley diversions killed a considerable number of NVA and diverted enemy attention, the SOG teams did not support the Arvin's return from Laos because the Arvin invasion force never got anywhere near the Ashaw. Lam Sun 719, as Chief SOG had warned, had bogged down and become a bloody debacle with the Arvin's Laotian hilltop strongholds cut off and annihilated piecemeal. American TV crews witnessed the sickening sight of Arvin deserters mobbing Hueys and hanging from skids, the result of the NVA rushing in 10 infantry regiments from 5 divisions, plus tank and artillery regiments. Heavily supported by U.S. helicopters, most of Lam Sun 719's American killed and missing, 219 and 38, respectively, were air crew. The Arvin incurred severe losses in their 1st Division, South Vietnam's finest infantry unit, plus the 1st Airborne Division, the Marine Division, and the 1st Ranger Group. Chief SOG called the invasion the biggest fiasco I saw in my whole time over there, because it broke the back of the South Vietnamese Army. Particularly irreplaceable were the dead Arvin paratroop officers, he said, since that's the Gavins, the Westmorelands, if you will, the future leaders. They were all dead. After Lam Son, the Arvin all but abandoned Western First Corps and the DMZ, yielding immense areas to the NVA, and it became SOG's job to find these new redoubts and document what the enemy was doing in them. Ominously, in April, CCN teams discovered a new road coming out of Laos just north of the Ashaw, pointed dangerously toward the populous coastal plain north of Hue. Heavy NVA forces made penetrations all but impossible. It was as if a curtain were being lowered to conceal enemy activities. Sent to penetrate that veil, on 3 May, R.T. Asp, consisting of Staff Sergeants Klaus Bingham, James Luttrell, Lewis Walton, and 3 yards, landed without ground fire in the Ashaw Valley. It seemed R.T. Asp had slipped safely past the NVA. 10 minutes after landing, they radioed a team OK and went on their way. That was the last transmission from R.T. Asp. There were indications they may have been captured, the SOG report noted. Then on 17 May, another team in the Ashaw Valley, RT Alaska, was overrun by hordes of NVA. Although the bodies of Specialist 4 Gary Hollingsworth and Staff Sergeant Dale Denke were recovered, their 1-0, 1st Lieutenant Danny Entrecan, was MIA. With strong intelligence, he'd been taken alive. The body retrieval proved so perilous that the Bright Light team leader, Sergeant Richard Hendrick, was awarded a Distinguished Service Cross. Another SOG team in the Ashaw, however, paid back the NVA in spades. Occupying a small peak, the SOG team used a mortar and recoilless rifle to pin NVA trucks and troops along Highway 548, then brought in USAF AC-119 gunships night after night. Along with 2 other teams, they interdicted the road for 21 days, destroying 15 NVA trucks and inflicting numerous enemy casualties at a cost of 2 Americans and 4 yards slightly wounded. Despite occasional SOG successes, though, the NVA continued to expand and extend their security curtain. From the Ashaw Valley north to the DMZ, a distance of 75 miles, the North Vietnamese reigned nearly supreme by June 1971, with Khe San again empty, and Long Ve Special Forces Camp, a ghost town. In Vietnam's entire northwest region, the last burr under the NVA's saddle was a CCN radio relay site, Outpost Hickory, situated on a peak 21.2 miles north of Khe San. The closest friendlies were at fire bases Fuller and Carroll, 20 miles east of there. Although ostensibly only a radio relay site, Hickory's greatest utility was as a secret NSA radio monitoring post, using state-of-the-art automated equipment to intercept enemy radio traffic. Just 29 yards wide and 73 yards long, Hickory was held by 27 U.S. and 67 indigenous soldiers, including SOG men, sensor readers, and a squad from L Company, 75th Rangers. The site was commanded by CCN Staff Sergeant John Caviani, who, despite being outranked by several Americans, led the Montagnard Security Platoon, assisted by Sergeant John Jones. That Hickory was threatened came as no surprise. For weeks, Saigon analysts electronically tracked units closing in on the little base so closely that Lieutenant Colonel Mike Radke finally announced an assault was imminent. "I said 72 hours, and it was hit within 24," he recalled. Due to its valuable radio intercept role, SOG planned to hold Hickory until it became untenable. At dawn on 4 June, a security man pointed to something odd in Hickory's concertina wire. Looking closer, Caviani realized it was a Chinese claymore mine and noticed 10 more all along the perimeter, planted the previous night during a blinding downpour. Caviani grabbed an M60 machine gun and began knocking down the mines with gunfire, disabling 6. Then, kaboom, one mine detonated, wounding several men. Then, kaboom, another mine exploded, wounding more men, including John Jones, slightly. The NVA's intended effect fizzled and a simultaneous ground assault never materialized, though 60 yards downhill, several dug-in enemy fired sporadically. Scrambling through a 50-caliber machine gun, Caviani let loose a furious fusillade, matched by fire from other defenders just as the NVA launched a mortar and RPG barrage. A few more defenders suffered shrapnel wounds. While a pair of F-4 Phantoms bombed the entrenched NVA, a young American sensor reader named Walton climbed into the 50-caliber's bunker with Caviani, who took one look at his pudgy frame and thick glasses and asked what he wanted. "I came up here to take over the 50 cal," he said. "There are a lot of guys roaming around like they don't know what to do." He was right. Caviani had to lead the defense, not fight it all alone. Caviani put a yard with Walton and took off to reposition men, distribute ammo, and secure the wounded, which by now numbered more than a dozen. When an RPG rocked the 50 caliber's position, Caviani looked up to see the wounded Walton drag the gun back. For a moment, the sensor reader thought he was blind, but then learned the RPG had only damaged his glasses. He resumed firing. Another RPG hit a U.S. captain. With Walton's supporting fire, Caviani carried the officer across the helipad to an Arvin medic. Then another mortar barrage shook Hickory, and a sniper in a spider hole opened fire only to be shot dead by Caviani. More Americans, Yards, and Vietnamese were hit by shrapnel. The situation seemed to have become untenable, so Caviani called for an evacuation, which began early that afternoon. Caviani carried the wounded captain to a Huey and told him Walton had knocked out 5 NVA machine guns and exposed himself to a lot of fire. So Caviani had hastily written him up for the Medal of Honor. He wanted the captain to carry the recommendation back to Da Nang. Caviani then hustled Walton and as many others as he could squeeze aboard onto another helicopter. After it lifted away, there stood Walton, grinning, claiming he'd fallen out. With Walton's and Jones' help, Caviani began scuttling gear so they all could leave in the next helicopter lift. He was careful to destroy the NSA van and its top-secret radio intercept gear. Except for an occasional mortar round, the action had ebbed by 4:30 p.m. when Caviani heard a Huey coming in and received a shocking radio message. "This is the last ship. Get on it." The Huey had room for 7 passengers, he protested. He had 4 times that many men. Never before had a SOG American abandoned his indigenous soldiers, and Caviani was not about to be the first. He put Walden aboard the Huey along with 6 Yards and waved them off. With that last load, he'd evacuated 69 men, 15 of them wounded, leaving 19 yards, 4 Vietnamese, the slightly wounded John Jones and himself. Caviani couldn't understand what was happening. It wasn't even 5 p.m. The sky was clear and SOG couldn't get helicopters. It didn't make sense. But all was not lost. A Thailand-based USAF Jolly Green was en route to Hickory to extract Caviani and his men. But when the big Sikorsky was 7 miles away, the pilot radioed, "I just got told I will get court-martialed if I don't turn this bird around." It was a bureaucratic pissing contest instigated by a senior officer of the U.S. division then providing helicopter support to SOG. Not only had he terminated Huey's support at 5 p.m., but when he learned SOG had gone through its own channels to get the Jolly Green, he'd contacted MACV headquarters and had 7th Air Force turn the Thailand-based aircraft around. The contest had begun 2 weeks earlier, when the senior officer suddenly demanded that his division's helicopters supporting CCN be returned. Impossible, because recon men were at that moment locked in a firefight, their lives on the line. Colonel Petzel, said the officer, apparently didn't think much of unconventional warfare. Although General Abrams formally ordered the U.S. division to provide SOG with helicopter support, the officer found ways around it. Petzel explained, without just refusing the order, they could say, "Well, the helicopters aren't available. Christ, we've got maintenance problems, etc., etc." Or, "We had too many shot up." Or this and that and the other thing. And then they would show up with fewer than necessary, and they'd come late. That was their way of fighting the requirement. Colonel Petzel and Chief SOG went to Abrams several times, but there was a reluctance, apparently, to enforce compliance, and Abrams expected SOG to solve its own problems. It was an arrangement courting disaster, which came on 4 June 1971 at Outpost Hickory, where Caviani and Jones kept looking to the sky for evacuation birds, but none appeared. Realizing they were on their own with night fast approaching, Caviani had Jones take the radio while he stood atop a bunker, surveying what could be done to improve defenses. Shaped like an hourglass, with the helipad in its narrow neck, Hickory straddled a slightly rising ridgeline with steep drop-offs on the sides. Caviani decided to abandon the lower half, concentrating his men on the higher, north half, so they could shoot downhill as the enemy came across the open helipad. To slow the NVA, he placed on the helipad a booby-trapped 4.2-inch mortar shell that would explode when touched. From the outhouse he dragged the wash-tub-size honey bucket and cut a shooting port, then hid a yard machine gunner there behind sandbags. Next he positioned 2 more machine guns to provide crossfire on the helipad, then he built a little firing position for himself atop a bunker so he could see over the pad. And by 7 p.m. the sun sank below Korok Mountain, and as it got dark a thick fog rolled over Hickory, just as a USAF AC-119 Stinger gunship arrived. An hour later came the first probes. The booby-trapped mortar shell exploded and several NVA cried out and fell back. The fog was so dense that the Stinger couldn't fire. It was quiet for an hour and a half. Then 15 NVA rushed onto the helipad, right into the intersecting fire of the 3 machine guns. By the time they saw the muzzle flashes, they were dead. 10 minutes later came another 15 NVA with the same result. Then another 15. 8 times they stormed the helipad, and each time the SOG defenders mowed them down until, just after midnight, the enemy pulled back to reconsider. Caviani discerned the NVA were about to launch a mass assault, so he shifted his men into Hickory's heaviest bunkers. But the NVA struck while the yards were pulling back, and in the confusion dozens of enemies stormed over the helipad and across Hickory. Standing atop a bunker, Caviani fired a few rounds, then realized he was exposed, and bent over to get down. An AK slug hit the small of his back, tearing flesh almost to his shoulder, knocking him to the ground. He rolled into a bunker with John Jones and radioed the Stinger, "I've got 80 to 100 people in the open. My people are all under cover. Come in from the northeast to the southwest." Fearing friendly casualties, the pilot refused, Caviani again called for a gun run, this time giving his initials. If you don't know what my initials mean, it means I accept full responsibility for this fire mission. Fire! But the gunship pilot would not fire. By now, NVA could be heard going bunker to bunker, shooting and tossing grenades. Any second, they'd find the two Americans. Caviani pulled his Gerber MK2 fighting knife and announced, "Anybody comes through the door, I'll take him." As quickly, two NVA climbed in, one with a flashlight and his rifle slung over his back, the second his rifle at the ready. Caviani seized the second NVA's hair and jammed his dagger up through his chin, killing him. Then Jones shot the other NVA, who rolled out the door, screamed, and collapsed. Momentarily, a hand grenade bounced in, which wounded Jones seriously and all but deafened Caviani. Too badly injured to resist further, Jones announced, "John, I'm going to surrender," and climbed out. An NVA soldier yelled, an AK fired, and Jones tumbled back in, dead. Then another grenade fell into the bunker and exploded, and knocked Caviani unconscious, also destroying his radio. When he groped back to consciousness, it was still dark, but he could feel a fresh leg wound and blood flowing from his ears. At the sight of flickering flashlights, he played dead, leaving his eyes wide open and unblinking while an NVA prodded his chest with an AK. Satisfied, the NVA pulled a cigarette lighter and set the bunker's tar paper ceiling afire, then went outside with other NVA to watch the flames. Hot tar dripped on Caviani's face and his pants caught fire, but he dared not move. The torture was excruciating. Finally, he decided, "I'm going to John Wayne these bastards," and tried to jump to his feet, but rubble had collapsed on him and he had to squeeze and heave to free himself. The NVA soldiers had walked away. Exhausted, he stumbled out the door just as a slug cooked off from a burning machine gun. The round grazed his head and knocked him out. When he awoke, the bunker was burned out. It was pitch black, and he could hear the enemy looting Hickory. Gooey, burned skin hung from his fingers. When a rummaging NVA almost stepped on him, Caviani pulled his final weapon, the Gerber knife, and slammed it so hard into the man's chest that he couldn't extract it. Only pulled burned skin from his hand. Just before dawn, he crawled through the wire, slid down a cliff face, and evaded toward Firebase Fuller. After Hickory fell, a U.S. spokesman told the Associated Press there was no report of any such base. For 10 days, Caviani stumbled, crawled, and dragged himself eastward before reaching Firebase Fuller one morning at 3 a.m. He decided to sleep and wait until dawn to approach the wire. At sunrise, he stood, and an old man stuck a bolt-action rifle in his back. Momentarily, 5 more communists appeared, and Caviani was on his way to Laos, a POW. The NVA beat Caviani severely, trying to learn what he knew of the NSA van. He maintained he was only an NCO and not privy to whatever secrets the mysterious van possessed. Eventually, the NVA trucked him, 2 surviving yards and his Vietnamese interpreter to Vinh, where they boarded a train for Hanoi. When they arrived, Caviani's interpreter dropped all pretense of being a fellow prisoner and proudly donned the uniform of an NVA intelligence officer. He was an enemy mole. The North Vietnamese did not admit capturing Caviani for a year. Then in March 1973, he was released with other U.S. POWs. For his determined, selfless defense of Hickory, Caviani was awarded the Medal of Honor in 1974. After the Hickory helicopter fiasco, SOG reassigned its own 20th SOS Green Hornet Hueys to CCN. Never again would a SOG man be abandoned due to institutional or personal vanities. In early August, CCN RT Kansas was assigned the job of penetrating the NVA curtain near Khe Sanh. No small task, since there were as many NVA there in 1971 as during the 1968 siege. For several months, U.S. intelligence had monitored a major concentration of NVA gradually moving across the DMZ, then down South Vietnam's Cam Lo River Valley, about a dozen miles east of Khe San. What they were up to seemed a mystery best solved by interrogating a fresh NVA prisoner. Studying his mission, the RT Kansas 1-0, First Lieutenant Lauren Festus Hagen, brainstormed with his 1-1, Sergeant Tony Fast Eddie Anderson, and 1-2, Sergeant Bruce Berg. In recent months, there had been a flurry of heavily armed teams landing on old fire bases, shooting the hell out of the enemy and extracting. Why not try that? Except, only extract about half the team, leaving the other half hidden on the hill. When the NVA sent a squad up there to see if the Americans had left anything behind, as the NVA always did, the stay-behind element would ambush them, seize a prisoner, and come out. It was perfect, and it would take only 24 hours. Lieutenant Hagen decided to take 14 men, reinforcing his team with three strap hangers, Staff Sergeant Orrin Bingham and Sergeants Bill Queen and William Rimondi, for 8 yards and 6 U.S. Everyone was confident and upbeat under Hagen's leadership. Easygoing and smart, the Fargo, North Dakota native was one of those rare junior officers who thrived on special forces informality, yet didn't become one of the boys. He was both liked and respected. RT Kansas inserted at last light on 6 August 1971, landing on the old hilltop fire base just 50 yards wide. Hagen's men went to work immediately, restoring its two dilapidated bunkers and shallow trenches and digging in their heaviest weapon, a 60-millimeter mortar. Surveying the scrub brush and bomb craters below them, Hagen split his defense into three sectors to fit three slopes, grouping together Berg and Rimondi on the south, 1-1 Anderson and several yards to the northwest, with himself, Bingham, Queen, and the rest of the yards covering the west. Hagen could see that several approaches afforded decent cover and concealment, especially to the south. Still, with a C-130 Spectre above them, they could throw back any force the NVA could muster at short notice, and besides, they only had to hold the hilltop one night. Just to be safe, he positioned Tony Anderson, his most experienced NCO, who had both an M60 machine gun and a Kar-15, to cover the most vulnerable slope. Certainly the NVA had seen them land, and Hagen reckoned to be ready for them. Indeed, the North Vietnamese had seen RT Kansas 2 Hueys hover above the old fire base, instigating a phone call to the nearby 304th NVA Division headquarters, which found the recon team's presence intolerable. From the little hilltop, RT Kansas' first inkling of an NVA presence came at 9 p.m., well after dark, when they saw campfires in the ridgelines north and west of them, unusual because the enemy normally masked himself. At midnight, the NVA fired shots below the hill from north, south, east, and west. The SOG men had never seen such wide-scale probing and, of course, didn't return fire. At 1 a.m. Spectre arrived and the team invisibly marked their perimeter with infrared strobe lights. The big C-130 gunship fired for them all night, walking 40-millimeter and 20-millimeter rounds within 10 yards of them. Not once did RT Kansas fire, staying blanketed protectively in darkness. Then at 3 a.m. they heard trucks arrive and tailgates dropping. It was odd, very odd. Beneath the hill, dismounting NVA soldiers formed up into platoons and companies, which their leaders marched in careful order to their assigned attack positions to wait for dawn. Just before sunrise, the enemy ceased probing fire, and it became forebodingly quiet. Then the SOG men heard more trucks. At Phu Bai, Covey and a flight of helicopters was lifting away for the planned false extract. They would be above RT Kansas in 30 minutes. Already, Lieutenant Hagen had radioed Covey, telling him something was developing, that the NVA were moving through the heavy ground fog. As darkness gave way to light, Hagen detected glimpses of enemy on one slope, which his men could certainly handle. Then on another slope, NVA pith helmets were seen bobbing in the fog, and he grew concerned, especially since he didn't know anything about the third slope. When his men reported NVA there, too, Hagen realized the entire hill was ringed by NVA, a force spread so wide that it would have to be more than 1,000 men, a whole regiment. The NVA regimental commander understood he had to dispatch the Americans and do it quickly. R.T. Kansas had inadvertently landed almost within sight of the Hanoi High Command's most critical new venture, the first 6-inch fuel pipeline laid across the DMZ and down the Cam Lo River Valley, absolutely essential in a few months when entire tank battalions would roll through here for the war's largest offensive. Already the NVA 304th Division, plus a regiment of the 308th Division, were massing nearby, preparing for the offensive. A 4th NVA battalion commander radioed that his men were in place and prepared to assault. Ground fog concealed them from American airstrikes, so the regimental commander waited for yet a 5th battalion to get into position, by which time he'd have committed nearly 2,000 infantrymen to crush R.T. Kansas. Later, Chief Sog Sadler would learn an entire regiment had stormed the hill, supported by a 2nd regiment, the most one-sided fight of the war. A regiment was all it took to overrun Kham Duk Special Forces Camp in 1968, one-third that many NVA swallowed up Long Vey Special Forces Camp in one night. Here on this remote, scrub-covered hill, R.T. Kansas' 14 men with Kar-15s, grenade launchers, and a single M-60 machine gun were outnumbered 107-1, a mismatch 7 times greater than that of the Alamo. As the truth became evident, Lieutenant Hagen saw there was no time for gestures or inspiring words, just serious soldier work. He spent those final moments repositioning men and weapons, readying grenades and stacking magazines. 1-1 Anderson crawled out and checked their claymores to ensure they hadn't been turned around or disabled. The Catholic Montagnards made the sign of the cross. Then the NVA came. A single, well-aimed RPG round smashed into Bruce Berg's bunker, collapsing it and signaling the attack. As if a dam had burst, NVA fire went from nothing to all out in 2 seconds. 10,000 rounds per second were striking a space the size of a tennis court. Hagen looked to Berg's bunker and shouted to Anderson, "We're getting hit on that side. We're being assaulted." At the same time, Anderson could see dozens of NVA rushing in lines up his slope and was meeting them with his M60 machine gun. Hagen hollered that he was going to check Berg. Anderson nodded to one yard. "Tao, go with him." Tremendous AK fire was cutting the air from all directions. Terrible fire, equal to 50 miniguns sweeping back and forth. But Berg could be bleeding to death. So Hagen ran directly into the maelstrom toward the collapsed bunker, bullets ricocheting and slamming the earth in front of, behind, and beneath his dashing feet. Momentarily, Cao trotted back to Anderson and shouted, "The Trung Wei, Lieutenant, is dead." Hagen had hardly gone a dozen yards when fire from NVA rushing up another slope cut him down. Then Klaus Bingham left the bunker to reposition a claymore and didn't get 6 feet before a bullet struck him in the head, apparently killing him. The yard with Bingham could not even risk checking him, the fire was so furious. 1 yard in a trench below Anderson fired several bursts, then jumped up to pull back. He attracted intense fire and fell into Anderson's lap, dead. The bullet that struck him would have hit Anderson had the yard not taken it instead. 4 men had died in less than 4 minutes. It was up to Anderson now, the senior man. Small arms fire rattled closer on all sides, and grenades lobbed up from below the hill crest beyond the defenders' vision. The danger wasn't just the NVA they saw, but the more numerous enemy crawling and scurrying nearer behind small rises and from bomb crater to bomb crater. Anderson dashed across the hill to look for Hagen, but couldn't see him anywhere, just 100 khaki-clad NVA almost at the top. He ran back for his M60, fired one belt at NVA coming up his own slope, then sped to the other approach and ran belt after belt on the 100 assaulting enemy. By then, grenades started coming from behind him as NVA closed in from his rear. Now within a dozen yards, just beyond the curvature of the hill, NVA popped up their heads, cracked a few shots at Anderson, then dropped back down. Covey arrived. Took one look at that hillside alive with NVA, scrubbed the snatch mission, and called for fighters. But it would be more precious minutes before they were overhead. Fighting a westerly headwind, the helicopters were still a dozen minutes away. The Cobra gunships went to full throttle, leaving the slower Hueys behind. Meanwhile, RT Kansas was pulling hand grenade pins, counting to three, then heaving the grenades to airburst above the NVA. Then they were out of grenades. A North Vietnamese grenade exploded beside Anderson's M60, rendering it useless. He spun his Car-15 off his back and kept shooting. Then he tossed back one enemy grenade that went off in front of him, leaving bright spots in his vision, but he kept shooting. More shrapnel tore into him. Then an AK round slammed through his web gear and lodged in his elbow, knocking him down. He stumbled back to his knees and kept shooting. The perimeter was pinched almost in half when Anderson grabbed his two remaining yards, circled below and around the nearest NVA, and somehow managed to reach the survivors on the opposite side. He found Bingham, started to lift him, and saw he too was dead from a head wound. All around him he heard zzz, 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 as bullets flashed past his ears. Anderson dragged Bingham's body back to where Bill Queen lay, wounded. Only Raimondi wasn't yet hit and still fired furiously. Anderson put them in a back-to-back circle just off the hilltop where they would make their last stand. An AK slug already had destroyed their team radio. Another had shot Anderson's little survival radio out of his hand, so Raimondi tossed the 1-1, another survival radio, their last. Now the NVA were streaming, rolling over the hill crest like a tidal wave, their rattling AKs blending together into one never-ending burst. Anderson's men were shooting not at NVA, but at hands-wielding AKs over parapets and around bunkers. There was no place left to fall back, and they could no longer spare 5 seconds to talk to Covey. Anderson was shooting NVA not much farther away than the end of his Car-15's muzzle. The time it took to speed charge a Car-15 magazine meant life or death. From the air it looked like an ant mound, with moving figures everywhere. Cobra lead rolled in and sparkled 20mm cannon shells around the surviving RT Kansas men, while Covey's OV-10 slipped sideways to strafe with machine guns and rockets. Then at last fighters arrived, adding splashing napalm and groaning Vulcan cannons to the melee. Precise Cobra gunship fire stacked NVA in front of RT Kansas' final holdouts. Then at last the assault ebbed, turned, and the surviving NVA fled for cover, just as the Hueys arrived. The smoke-shrouded hill was an unforgettable sight. Beneath wisps of napalm flames lay khaki-clad bodies all the way up the slopes, then heaps of dead NVA radiated outward from a handful of dark green figures. Though wounded repeatedly, Anderson crawled out to fire his Car-15 to cover the landing Hueys as they came in, machine guns blazing, while their escorting Cobra gunships sprayed cannon and minigun fire all around them. With Raimondi's help, Anderson got as many teammates' bodies as he could find aboard the first Huey, then helped the wounded Queen and others aboard the second. Under intense fighter and Cobra attack, few NVA fired at the Hueys as they lifted away. Despite his wounds 3 hours later, Anderson accompanied the Bright Light mission, commanded by Noel Gast, which included RT's Cobra and Indiana, along with Jimmy Reeves and Sam Injun Adams, and even the CCN commander, Lieutenant Colonel Donnie Belfi. They searched the hilltop and recovered Lieutenant Hagen's body and those of several Montagnards, but never found Bruce Berg. Already the NVA had recovered their own bodies and withdrawn. The Bright Light team withdrew under light ground fire. Lieutenant Hagen had died, along with Bingham. Berg was presumed dead. 3 yards had died. Raimondi and Queen both suffered multiple frag wounds. Anderson had been struck by both small arms fire and shrapnel, and their other yards, too, had all been wounded. Against this, Tony Anderson learned, The USAF had confirmed that 185 NVA lay dead on that hill. Little R.T. Kansas had wiped out half a battalion. But compared to the loss of his best friends, that gave Anderson sparse satisfaction. The R.T. Kansas debriefing resulted in one of SOG's most dramatic documents, and a quote from Anderson so inspired Colonel Petzl that he had it engraved on a plaque. I looked up at the bunker in front of me and saw a khaki-uniformed NVA with pith helmet, chest web gear, green Bata boots, and an AK Type 56, and no other identifying insignia. Then I shot him. It's just perfect, Petzl said. It epitomized the SOG soldier who knew what his job was, which was gathering intelligence. Then he turns around and fights when he has to. First Lieutenant Lauren Hagen's family was presented the U.S. Army's final Vietnam War Medal of Honor. Tony Anderson, his 1-1, who held together what remained of R.T. Kansas through those final mass assaults, received the Distinguished Service Cross, while Queen, Rimondi, Berg, and Bingham were awarded Silver Stars. A few days after coming off the hill, Tony Anderson took the bodies of his three Montagnard teammates to their little village, a place where they'd feasted and drunk rice wine together. As his truck rolled in, fearful women looked up from their work, knowing unannounced visitors meant bad news, and sobbing started as soon as the truck halted. The entire village gathered at the headman's longhouse, where in their tribe's tradition, Anderson told of the fallen men's bravery and the many NVA they'd killed. It gave comfort to mothers and sisters to know their men had fought honorably, and to the brothers and fathers, great pride that they'd killed so many of the detested North Vietnamese. The Montagnard boys' dark eyes watched as they hung on Anderson's every detail as the interpreter related the battle. Despite the tragedy, there was pride in the village. When Anderson returned to his truck, he found a cluster of nervous Montagnard boys, one of whom explained they wanted to return with him, learn how to fight, and go kill the NVA. Most of the eager faces belonged to 13 and 14-year-olds, standing erect and swelling their chests to look older. Anderson nodded to the two oldest, who grinned and scrambled happily aboard the truck. SOG's secret war continued into the fall of 1971, as teams documented the continuing NVA buildup. By October, 7 of every 9 missions had teams fighting for survival, yet they were always ready to go back, as if it were still 1965, and America was fighting to win. In early October, USAF Captain Jim Cryer and I spotted an NVA regiment walking a Laotian road in broad daylight, which led to 3 days' incessant bombing, directed as well by Covey riders Lowell Stevens and Larry White, which practically wiped out the entire unit, quite likely one of the most effective air attacks of the war. That same month, NVA tanks were spotted in southern Laos, their first significant appearance there in over 2 years. When CCC Commander Lieutenant Colonel Mike Radke reported this, the civilian Second Corps advisor John Paul Vann shouted, "That's a lot of horse shit." Van's humility returned as evidence mounted. In Saigon, there was a hesitance to accept SOG's warnings by minimizing and nitpicking intelligence reports, which came to a head during a briefing for General Abrams. Chief SOG had just presented recon team reports of tanks and tank trails coming out of Laos, when a MACV staff officer began demanding arcane details before the intelligence could be accepted. Abrams suddenly grew furious, slammed his fist on the table and barked, "I don't know what you want these soldiers to do. Do you want them to personally bring back the battalion flag so you can see what the hell his unit is before you believe? Because goddammit, I send these guys out there. They have the worst job in this command and do it brilliantly. And they bring back intelligence and they risk their lives and you guys sit on your hands and say, 'We don't believe this shit.'" There were no further credibility problems. Each evening that fall, SOG data was consolidated and rushed to a courier plane which carried the intelligence to Paris, allowing American negotiators to follow the NVA buildup and refer to it in their deliberations. When North Vietnamese negotiator Le Duc Tho walked out on Henry Kissinger's secret talks that November, Kissinger fully understood a major new offensive was in the offing. While on a recon mission on 11 October, Sergeant First Class Audley Mills was killed, SOG's final ground fatality. He was on his third Vietnam combat tour. During November, 8 of 11 recon teams spent less than 2 hours on the ground before large numbers of NVA forced them out. Then in December, one last recon team dared to penetrate the Aisha Valley, found tracked vehicles, called airstrikes on NVA trucks, and made it out unscathed. SOG's combat role came to a quiet, unacknowledged close. SOG's men had acquitted themselves bravely, to the very end. Afterward. It was several more months before SOG disbanded officially, an event as unheralded as its creation had been 8 years earlier. But during those secretive years, SOG had logged a combat record unequaled in U.S. history. The Vietnam War's most highly decorated unit, with 5 Medals of Honor, was SOG's understrength 60-man recon company at Con Tum. Surely no unit that size had been so decorated since the Civil War. And in that final perilous year when SOG fought alone, Da Nang-based CCN, with only about 70 combat operatives, earned 2 Medals of Honor and 3 Distinguished Service Crosses. Among SOG's recon units, Purple Hearts were earned at a pace unparalleled in American wars of this century, with casualties at times exceeding 100%. Although steep relative to the numbers of men involved, of course, SOG's losses were small compared to the war's overall American casualties. SOG's precise losses, however, remain difficult to pin down because the U.S. government falsely attributed those killed or missing in North Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia to combat in South Vietnam. In July 1973, the Defense Department attempted to make a clean breast of it, admitting to the New York Times that 81 American servicemen, most of the members of the special forces, had been killed in Laos and Cambodia since 1965, while on secret missions. But the double bookkeeping system proved so confounding that the Pentagon had understated casualties, a fact that became evident when families of MIAs demanded more information. Today, although the records remain imperfect, it is apparent that more than 300 SOG Americans were lost, 57 of them MIA. As recently as 1991, for example, SOG's first MIA in Laos, Larry Thorne, was incorrectly listed as missing in South Vietnam. Most SOG MIAs were bodies left behind when teams were about to be overrun. But a sizable portion of those missing, perhaps 15 or more, were likely captured, their disappearance a grim testament to the vindictiveness with which those who dared to trespass in the NVA's backyard were treated. Not only does Hanoi continue to deny any knowledge of these men, it still insists it never had troops in Laos, and its post-war maps depict the Ho Chi Minh Trail as having been inside South Vietnam. SOG Recon and Hatchet Force operations were the most successful economy of force in U.S. history, pulling away tens of thousands of NVA from the battlefields of South Vietnam for rear security duty in Laos and Cambodia. At one point, each American Green Beret operating in Laos was tying down 600 NVA defenders, or about one NVA battalion per SOG recon man in the field. U.S. Marine and Army units benefited from SOG's destruction or capture of thousands of tons of munitions and supplies, which thereby could not be used against them. No small contribution, either. Thousands of enemy soldiers killed by SOG men would never fight in South Vietnam. SOG recon men consistently killed more than 100 NVA for each lost Green Beret, a ratio that climbed as high as 150 to 1, which MACV documented in 1969. This was the highest documented kill ratio of any American unit in the war, exceeding the average by a factor of 10, and quite likely is the highest such ratio in U.S. history. Still more lives were saved when SOG's intelligence enabled U.S. forces to counter or pinpoint the NVA, especially after American troops invaded Cambodia in 1970. To these many GIs saved indirectly must be added the lives saved directly when SOG bright light teams rescued downed pilots from deep behind NVA lines. Another legacy of SOG is the impact it had within the special operations community. The ever-dynamic Chief SOG, Jack Singlob, after retiring as a major general, influenced the congressional creation of Special Operations Command, lifting special ops to a career field for special forces officers and NCOs, while bringing together all services special ops units under a single headquarters. Special Forces received its own air arm, the 160th Aviation Regiment, to ensure today's Green Berets don't have to beg, borrow, and steal helicopters, as was the case with SOG. Just as the OSS helped define the path for the CIA and Special Forces, SOG's improvisations helped forge today's Special Ops doctrine for units such as Delta Force. Indeed, Delta Force's founding Sergeant Major was Walter Shoemate, while his primary trainer was Dick Meadows, both distinguished SOG veterans. By no casual coincidence, the U.S. Green Beret teams that landed deep behind Iraqi lines to rescue downed pilots during the Persian Gulf War were on bright light duty, their concept and operational procedures having evolved from SOG. Likewise, the Green Beret strategic reconnaissance teams that HALO parachuted into Iraq's Tigris and Euphrates river valleys were executing missions quite familiar to the SOG old hands, who had secretly developed such techniques 25 years ago. Visitors at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, today, can see hints of SOG's once-secret existence. The Special Warfare Museum is housed in Simon's Hall, named for SOG's shining brass chief, the burly Colonel Arthur Bull Simons, who also led the 1970 attempt to rescue POWs from North Vietnam's Son Tê prison. Then there's the vertical wind tower where Special Forces HALO parachutists perfect their skills, Strohline Hall, named for SOG HALO jumper Madison Strohline, MIA, and believed captured. Scattered here and there across the country are other small memorials. A highway rest stop near Rockford, Illinois bears the name of MIA Lieutenant Jerry Poole, the 10 of RT Pennsylvania. The family and friends of David Mixter, SOG's final MIA in Laos, donated a sailing sloop in his name to Maine's Hurricane Island Outward Bound, where today's young people might discover a love of the sea and sailing, such as he had known. Perhaps the most unique memorial is one to Walter Shoemate, the focus of Special Forces' longest-running practical joke. When Shoemate died 2 years ago, Cliff Newman, 10 of SOG's first HALO team, skydived above Delta Force's top-secret compound at Fort Bragg to scatter Shoemate's ashes. In accordance with Walter's other last request, visitors to Delta's headquarters will find displayed under glass his handlebar mustache. Though they never cared much about rewards, in 1995 Cliff Newman and other SOG HALO jumpers finally were authorized to receive special HALO wings with a combat star attachment a quarter century after the fact. However, Charles Wilklow, the only SOG man to escape enemy captivity in Laos, was denied a POW service medal when that medal was created 4 years ago. The problem, his family was told, was a lack of records to document his capture because SOG's top-secret files had not been declassified. Wilklow passed away in 1992. It is men like Charles Wilklow, tremendous unsung heroes, that Chief SOG Steve Cavanaugh had in mind when he explained that his greatest disappointment was the lack of public recognition for SOG men's secret missions. They were the greatest troops our Army ever had, said Colonel Roger Petzel, and I'd put him up against anybody's. His opinion is shared by SOG's former adversaries, the North Vietnamese. Nguyen Thong Lai, an NVA officer who'd served on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, said SOG's Green Berets effectively attacked and weakened our forces and hurt our morale because we could not stop these attacks. We understood that these American soldiers were very skillful and very brave in their tactics to disrupt infiltration from the north. Another former NVA told writer Al Santoli that SOG recon men were unquestionably America's finest fighters in the war. Despite the war's outcome, SOG veterans carry an intense pride at having performed dangerous missions among brave men, and their good memories outweigh the bad ones. "It was the best assignment I had," said Blackbird crewman Don James, a sentiment almost universal among SOG veterans. "If you had to sell parts of your life," explained 10 Will Curry, "the last piece I'd sell is the 18 months I spent running recon at Khon Tum. SOG fades into the past, its secret initials taking their place among distinguished ranks, OSS, SOE, JACK, CIA. Old recon men still gather to toast departed comrades and sing, "Hey Blue," reciting name after name. The war may be forgotten, but those names are not. SOG, The Secret Wars of America's Commandos in Vietnam, was written by John Plaster and read by Arthur Morey. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. SOG, The Secret Wars of America's Commandos in Vietnam, is available in print from Simon & Schuster paperbacks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.